From the heart of the Forest City, focusing on the biggest stories in London, this is the Craig Needles Podcast. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
It is the Craig Needles Podcast, and it is the Friday Roundtable here as we wind down the last Friday Roundtable of January. So we're kind of moving through this month pretty quick and moving through winter pretty quick, although we actually finally got a blast of winter weather this week, and we might get another one this weekend. So if you're listening while you're shoveling or whatever it is you do, thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the Craig Needles Podcast. And here with us for the Friday Roundtable this week, we have political insiders Nathan Smith and Shobhita Sharma, as well as the newly appointed Chair of the London Police Services Board, Ali Chabar, is here as well. Ali, thank you very much for being here. Congratulations on the appointment.
I appreciate that, Craig. Thanks so much. Exciting year ahead with the police. A lot of big things we got to do, including hiring a chief and a deputy chief. So,
oh, and there's a contract, too.
And a contract, labor negotiations, and you know, a budget that we got to prepare and then get approved. So no shortage of issues there. But thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Are you sure you want to do this?
I mean, big bucks. They pay us big bucks there at the police board, right? So for your listeners, we don't get paid big bucks. Should be exciting.
There you go. Let's talk about some of the big stories in the news this week. And I wanted to start with hospital backlogs. And the LHSC came out and they talked to us on the news today and some of the other outlets and said, look, they're basically minus 1,000 when it comes to the backlog of child surgeries in this area right now. And that's obviously not just for London. They do they cover a lot of the province, but still, minus 1,000 is a scary number. And that's concerning for parents, concerning for obviously the kids who need these surgeries. Is this just a situation where the system is so broken that we're going to have to learn to live with news stories like this one, where every now and then it's just going to be, yeah, we have this huge backlog. I know that some of this is from COVID and some of this is from the illnesses that kind of move pretty quickly through schools. I just think that this is just going to be a regular thing for us going forward. What do you all think when you hear about 1,000 or nearly 1,000 surgery backlog at Children's Hospital?
I think it will be something we have to learn to live with for at least a little while, because you know this issue didn't just sort of arise in the last couple of years. It's been exacerbated by certain things, but this has been building for a long, long time, and it's going to take a long, long time, I think, to make some meaningful progress on it. It's pretty clear we need significant investments, whether that's in terms of more doctors, more spaces, or both. We might have to look at doing things differently, or it could be a combination of all those things, but the main point is that to do any of those things, it's going to take some time, and so this idea that we can just sort of turn it around with a simple snap of the fingers or a new policy or some new initiative, I just don't think it's realistic.
No, it's too big of a boat to stop on a dime, obviously. Ali, your thoughts on the story?
Yeah, I think there's probably a two-part answer to this. I mean, some of it's COVID-related, right? We see it play out in other facets of our society, right? I just was reading a story yesterday about, remember the big passport backlog, right? Thousands of people were waiting and I think the ministry came out and said, hey, guess what, everybody, good news. We've actually got through the backlog now. We've hired people. We're caught up those delays. The same delays that existed before or during COVID don't exist right now. So in one sense, I'm cautiously optimistic. Normally, I'm cautiously pessimistic when it comes to worldview, but I'm cautiously optimistic that hopefully over the next number of years, we can get caught up. That being said, to Nathan's point, this isn't a COVID issue. This has been an issue that's existed for us. It predates COVID by a great deal. And so you got to put in the effort and the resources. And we've seen some steps that have been taken by the government on that front, but there's nothing more important to us than our healthcare. And so, it's what I always find interesting is whenever you see these public surveys and list the top three most important things to you, it's always healthcare, education, and something else, right? I don't think anybody in the community is going to begrudge if we put more resources, we get more nurses, more doctors in place to try to deal with this backlog, because it's abstract until it isn't, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, COVID isn't the cause, but it's a cause, I think, because there were a lot of surgeries that were moved around because hospitals were busy dealing with kids with COVID, RSV, whatever it happens to be. Shobhita, is this just where we are now as a province where this sort of thing is going to be the deal?
I mean, are we here? Yes. Do we anticipate being here for a little bit? Maybe, but I don't think, to both Ali and Nathan's points, this is where we should have been, or that we will be in the future. Hopefully, not in the near future, because I think these are the stories that that hurt the most, right? Like these are kids.
Yep.
These are not elective surgeries, I think. These are necessary surgeries that these children need. And London being the center for the southwestern Ontario center for the children's hospital, I think it's important that that the backlog gets looked at and that it gets resolved.
Yeah. I want it resolved too. I just don't know how we do it. Like we said, it's you can't turn it around in a dime.
And even more to that point, anything that we do now, it's going to be like, it's going to take time until it's actually implemented. We see the effect of that, right? So you want to get rid of across provincial border restrictions on nurses coming to work in Ontario. Okay, well, that's going to take time to actually see an impact. Okay, we want to allow for more foreign trained physicians and nurses to come in and deal with those things. Well, it's going to take time for that to happen. We're going to implement other processes. It's going to take time. So there is no immediate fix. And that's why, to everybody's point, whatever we do today, we may not see the positive impact for that for another year, 2 years, 3 years, but something needs to be done. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, I am encouraged though, that it seems for the first time, at least in my lifetime, that there's a general recognition or admission that what we have right now isn't working. Yeah. And for the longest time, it was sort of a sacred cow and it was a point of national pride, as it should be, that, you know, we've got a great healthcare system, and in many ways we do, but because we were so proud of this thing, there was never any conversations about how we could make it better, whether it was more funding, whether it was slightly different ways of it was just like, no, it's perfect. It's the best healthcare system in the world, and we're Canadian, and we're good at hockey. And it's like, you couldn't talk about it. But now, and there's solutions all across the political spectrum, and I think all of them have merit, but I'm just encouraged that at least there's a conversation now and an acknowledgement that perhaps it's not the greatest healthcare system in the world, or it could be made better. And I think when you start on that path, some exciting things can happen. But again, as all of us have said, it's going to take a lot longer than we would like it to.
And I'm far from an anti-privatization zealot when it comes to healthcare, but I think that you have to be careful with it and be smart with it when it's happening. I don't know if the current provincial government is a group of people I would describe as either careful or smart. Like, you know, and that's the situation that we find ourselves in. So I'm not necessarily against changes, but I just want to see how these particular ones play out. And I call me a skeptic. Put it that way. Call me a skeptic.
Is there a provincial government in the past?
No.
20 years that you would characterize as smart or not?
Right? I knew where you were going, and I knew. Yeah. If the McGuinty or Wynn Liberals tried the same thing, I would say, well, I don't know about this. And I certainly would have, like, you know, we would have said the same thing about the Harris government. So yeah, it's not exactly the 27 Yankees of premiers that we've had recently. So I understand that if you have to make changes eventually, and at some point someone who may not necessarily be beloved is going to be in charge. I want to talk about another story as well that happened this week, and this one was in the downtown core. And look, sometimes there are problems with people who are unhoused in the downtown core. This is not necessarily new, but in this particular situation, London police say someone lit a fire in a recycle bin, which I suspect was filled with cardboard and paper and things along those lines, not far from a downtown apartment building. Two cars wound up getting scorched and are no longer useful. And if that fire had not been put out so quickly by members of the London Fire Department, it could have been a whole lot worse. And we could have talked about serious injuries, or perhaps even worse for people who live in that apartment building. And we could talk about serious damage within that apartment building, as now is limited to $160,000. But that number could have shot up real quick. And again, people could have got hurt or they could have gotten killed. I think people in this community, and we saw it when that $25 million was announced, are pretty compassionate when it comes to what's going on with homelessness in London. And I think that's a good thing. But I think compassion starts to run out when people look out their bedroom windows and see a two-story fireball. So does compassion have its limits, do you think, in this community? And I'm not saying that every homeless person's out there setting fires, but this is something to at least be considerate of is, hey, wait a minute, when stuff like this is going on, are people going to, I suppose, get frustrated to the point where maybe their political beliefs change a little bit, Shobha?
First, I think it is a really difficult situation when you see something like that outside your apartment. But I think it just calls, I think we just need to be even more compassionate. And also, it just brings into, it shines a light on how important anything, including those $25 million that are being put into homelessness, are, and how necessary it is to take action now and bring those changes, or bring a solution to the table now, because people need this help right now. I mean, situations like this definitely happened in Toronto as well. Like, we've heard of the fires under the Gardner Expressway, where people were just trying to stay warm, probably, and ended up in encampment fires, that the situations ended up that way. So I feel for everyone involved in the situation. But again, I think it is time to take action now.
I'm not so concerned about sort of the compassion meter, because I think a lot of people are heavily vested in this issue for compassionate reasons, and good on them. But I think a lot of people are invested in this issue based on self-interest and circumstance, which is also fine, as long as everybody's working towards a solution. So whether somebody loses compassion for the individuals, or they say, look, I never cared about them to begin with. All I want is this fix because it's impacting my business. They all are still heavily motivated towards finding a solution. And I don't think, for the people that are self-interested, I don't think the compassion really plays a role into why they want to be part of the solution. And I think as long as that exists, which I can't see it changing anytime, really. I mean, nobody, no matter what side you're on, no matter what, you know, whether it's conservative or New Democrat or liberal or whatever your beliefs may be, nobody believes that you can police your way out of this, where it's like, we got to get tough on these people. If we put them in jail, like, nobody believes that. They might be frustrated or have no compassion for the people, but nobody believes you can police your way out of this.
Well, and basic economics would tell you you can't.
Yeah. And I think everybody,
police officers are expensive and putting people in jail is expensive.
Yeah. So I think everybody's past that. So I'm not concerned about where the compassion meter is, because I think the interest level will remain as heightened as it has been until there is some significant progress that we see.
Ali, your thoughts on, you know, where people are at when it comes to what's going on with homelessness in the core, and sometimes it turns into some negative news stories.
Yeah, so your original question was, should compassion be, or is it becoming limited in that regard? And I would say that compassion should be unlimited. Mm-hmm. That being said, when it comes to matters of public safety, when it comes to matters of, you know, the security of those people that live in that complex, when we come to the ownership rights of those two cars, the people that own those two cars, you have competing interests right there. And you talk to the police, even anecdotally, and they'll say to you that a lot of times these are repeat offenders, right? These are individuals that the same guy that, and maybe I shouldn't specifically reference this same person, but the same, in a general abstract sense, a lot of the repeat things that are happening in the downtown core are being perpetrated by the same individuals over and over and over again, right? And so the police are frustrated, because it's like, well, you apprehend these individuals, then you send them over to the court system, then they go to court, and then they're released, and then you look at it, well, is it a mental health issue? Is it a resource issue? And it just feels like deja vu all over again, right? So there is a frustration. It's a palatable frustration amongst members of the London community, because it's like, this keeps happening over and over and over again. And we look to our leaders at City Hall, we look to our leaders in policing, we look to our leaders in the, you know, not-for-profit, and saying, well, what can we do to try to, I don't think we're ever going to be able to eliminate this, these types of things from happening in London, let alone the core. But I think we can take steps to mitigate the degree to which these things happen. But I think people, like, thank God that no one was harmed in this specific incident, yeah. Right? But could you picture the discussion if, heaven forbid, the building burnt down and somebody was killed, or people were killed, or there was actual, like, a loss of life or some catastrophic impairment to somebody? I think we're having a different conversation at that point. Maybe the root cause of the conversation is still similar, but the narrative is different. And I honest to God, at some point in the future, I pray it doesn't happen, but at some point in the future, I feel like sometimes these things are going to result in a loss of life. And then what? Then I feel like we're all maybe not culpable in a legal sense, but it's like, well, we saw this happening. It was a motor vehicle collision happening in slow motion, and we've done really a minimal amount to try to address some of these things.
And I think, like, to your point, I mean, investments in mental health, investments in housing then become so important, because they would ultimately lead to people feeling safer in the core, and people feeling like, well, they can come back to the core, but also the safety of the people who are currently unhoused and people getting the support and the services that they need. So I think, I feel like we've talked about this so much, but I think the ultimate solution is investing in people and investing mm-hmm. in our core, investing in those services that are needed right now.
And that's why it's going to be especially interesting to see what happens with this somewhere between $25 and $35 mm-hmm. million dollars that is currently something the City of London's discussing. Not necessarily people that work at the city right now, but people who are within various organizations in the city that are on the front lines talking about the best ways to spend that $25 million donation. And that, again, could cut up to $35 million with matching funds. And I think that there are a lot of ideas. Do any of you have something that jumps out to you as, hey, this is something we should be looking at, or hey, this is something that I'd want to see happen with that $25 million?
I guess what I would say on that front is the entire $25 million story was incredible. I think mm-hmm. it was a fantastic welcome thing for London. But I would hope that most people don't think that this is a silver bullet solution to the issue that we're talking about. It's fantastic. It's $25 million, and then there's, you know, a matching of $5 million. But $25 million, $30 million, $40, $50 million. We can't just throw money at the issue and think that money's going to resolve this. And further to the point that's been discussed, it's a multifaceted problem with, I think, that requires a multifaceted solution. So yes, it's dealing with homelessness. It's dealing about allocating resources properly in that regard. Yes, it's about mental health. Yes, it's about policing. Yes, it's about potentially even judicial reform, talking about what can be done on that level. But it's a big conversation that requires, like, it's all hands on deck. And so I just don't want people to think, oh, $25 million, $30 million, that's amazing. All right, well, now we're finally going to resolve this issue. It was never a question of resources or money in that, or solely purely about resources and money. It's really trying to get everybody to buy in into the fact that there is an issue, and what are the solutions.
And
there?
I think I like where you're going with it, because now with the donation coming through and all these groups being involved, I'm really hopeful and really optimistic, because we're looking at this as a collective responsibility versus just singling out either the city or like a couple of organizations and going to them for solution. I really like the community-led approach for finding a solution, finding better supports, basically finding a solution for housing in London. So, like I said, I'm hopeful and I'm optimistic that we will. It might not be a silver bullet, Ellie,
yeah,
but it might be something that starts us on that trajectory.
Yeah, and the money obviously captures people's attention, because a quick soundbite, and it's a significant amount. We've never seen that amount donated for this kind of thing in London's history. So it's significant in that regard. But I think what it really does is just validate the work that's being done and the process that's been undertaken, because that is unique. So that's where my optimism resides, in that, you know, there's a lot of, it's a cliche, but in this case, it's true. There's a lot of silos being broken down, a lot of groups working together in ways they've not worked together before, that had competing interests, that weren't at the table. They've come to the table and openly acknowledged, look, the way we've been doing things in the past hasn't worked. And so let's work with you, and let's work together, let's work here. And so we've never seen that kind of humility, and we've never seen that level of collaboration in London. And so I think the money, like I said, just validates that work. And that's what's truly significant. And that's why I'm very optimistic about what's coming out of this summit. And in the sort of collective willingness to implement it. It's not as if this was a group of, you know, small group of people that came up with something and is trying to convince everybody else to go along with it. It was developed in partnership over several months. Everybody appears to have bought into it and feels like they're part of the solution. And we haven't seen that before. And so I think the results will reflect that.
Well, coming out of the State of the City address, and in the room, you're never going to really get a lot of like instant pushback on this stuff. But you look online and you look at the stories that are posted on social media about the State of the City address and the $25 million. Typically, you can't get people on social media to agree as to whether the sun is going to come up tomorrow. But on this particular case, it was almost universal. Okay, great. This is something we really need. I hope this money is spent well.
To be fair, I haven't seen the sun for a while.
That's a good point.
I just want to put that out there.
That's a good point.
3 weeks,
it's,
maybe?
It's behind a cloud somewhere behind me right now. But generally, we're in a spot where there's always going to be disagreement. But there didn't seem to be a lot of disagreement on this. It wasn't a lot of push and pull. This was, all right, this is great news. Let's see what we can do with this cash, right?
Yeah. And if it's a catalyst for that type of discussion that we haven't been having, or maybe we've had that discussion in the past, but now we've narrowed the focus, or we're now looking at it from a different lens. Beautiful, amazing. Who can't support that, right? And the donation from the city, to both of your points, like, it's great. It's been a collaborative effort. Mm-hmm. It's clearly an identifiable problem that everybody recognizes. Any rational, logical person would recognize that this is an issue. And I think maybe even more so than the monetary value of the $25 million itself is the fact that now we're having this larger conversation. And I think that value, in my estimation, not to diminish or devalue the $25 million because it's an astronomical amount mm-hmm. of money, but I think there's greater value in the fact that we're finally, for the first time in a long time, we have that collective conscience on that, right? Mm-hmm. So whether, and we see it manifest itself. We were just talking just now about having that discussion about healthcare and having that realization from a community standpoint that there's something that needs to be done, right? We've had little flashes of that over the past number of years, whether we're talking about the residential schools and then finally the collective consciousness of this community, of the province, of the country now is focused on indigenous issues, or we're talking about Black Lives Matters, or we're talking about Islamophobia, or we're talking about whatever it is. I think sometimes more important than the money is the attention. Right. And the focus and the willingness of people to actually say, OK, you know what? We didn't think indigenous stuff was a problem, but now we realize that it is. We didn't think Black Lives Matters and racial discrimination was, but now it is. Islamophobia. And now we're talking about it as homelessness. Like, there's a window. There's a small window when you have people's attention span. And it's like that's when you have to seize on it. And I think we're in that window right now.
Yeah, I think so, too. And the next few weeks are going to be fascinating to me as far as what the plan looks like, how we want to do things. We talked about it last week with Cheryl and with Steve when they said, this maybe have to be something that turns into a capital expense, i.e. you're buying housing, whatever it happens to be, as opposed to the ongoing expense, because you can't just expect $25 million to fall out of the sky every year. You can't build this based on that. I don't know if that's the way it's going to turn out, but it's going to be fascinating to see. One last story I want to ask you all about before we wrap up here. And I think by now everyone's seen the video from Hamilton, Justin Trudeau walking through the street. And the entire thing seemed dangerous and quite frankly crosses the line. I'm fine with peaceful protest. I think everyone is. But was what we saw on that video from Hamilton when Justin Trudeau's walking down the street, and honestly, security didn't seem like super intense to the point where if someone wanted to take a shot at the guy, maybe they could have. Like, it felt that way to me. You would never see a United States president moving through a city street randomly like that, I don't think. People screaming in his face, they don't have any actual message. Have we become so polarized this is just going to be maybe not quite like this, but a regular scene, do you think?
Well, I don't think we're polarized. I think there's a small, I don't care if it's a buzzword. I think it is still a small fringe of people. It's a large enough fringe they can do a lot of damage. But I don't think we're polarized. I don't think there's sort of a huge mass on this side and another mass on the other side. I think this is a small sort of group that can be very dangerous and very loud and very visible. But who knows how long this will last, if this becomes the new normal, or if they'll just sort of burn themselves out or fracture or splinter even within this group and it becomes smaller and smaller as a result. I do agree with you 100% that we need to take security of national leaders, provincial leaders, a lot more seriously than we do at present. Because like you said, in the United States, and there's not a lot of areas I'd want to imitate the United States, but this is one where it just would not happen.
Would
that
you
way.
See Joe Biden just walking down some street and people screaming would get, in his face?
Get, like within 100 yards of him at best. And you see that at political events too, just the access you have to political leaders in Canada it's wide open.
But I feel like that's so Canadian. Like I feel like that access to your political representative is so
Canadian. And this is sad. Maybe it was.
It's so I know.
Yeah,
and
there's
that,
nothing.
I was
there's
just
nothing quaint about it until somebody gets shot or they get critically injured.
It didn't have to be that way.
No, but it and is, I think, and I'd rather guard against it.
I know. Come 110%. But I feel like we've lost that. We've lost that somewhere with I don't know. I think it was the anniversary of the Ottawa. Occupation recently. I think we lost it somewhere along there, but I'm so sad for it because that's not a protest, to your point, Craig. Like that is, I don't know what that is, but I wouldn't classify that as a protest. You just don't do that. That's scary. That is so scary, and it's so scary to know that that can happen at any political event that you go to, because remember, like at these political events, like it's not just the politicians who are there. There are people who have come to meet them. There, mm-hmm. there are volunteers. Yeah. There are kids.
Yeah. You were and that, you were here, were you not, when Justin Trudeau got the gravel thrown at him?
I was at the event. And it was not a good, it was not a pleasant situation because, like I said, there were so many volunteers, there were people there, there were patrons of the institution where we were, but there were also kids in the group. That was not safe.
But if the nicest possible way I could describe it is exactly how you said, it wasn't a pleasant situation. If I'm like thinking, how can I describe gravel being thrown at the Prime Minister in the nicest possible way? It would be, it was an unpleasant situation. As far as I'm concerned, it was disgusting. It was deplorable. It was such a break from what historically has been the Canadian tradition when it comes to these things. And sadly, for me, it's emblematic of this incrementalism that we've seen over the last number of years where, yes, Canada, the Canada we remember, or aspects of the Canada we remember. Yeah, there was a time when I was in university when I went up to Ottawa and I went to do a tour of Parliament, and just completely oblivious because I'm a dumb 21-year-old kid, I walked right up to the front door of Parliament. I opened the door and I walked in, and I got about 15 steps in before a security guard quite literally said to me in the nicest terms, "Hello, sir, can I help you?" And I said, "Yeah, I think there's a tour or something going on in here." And he says, "Oh, no, sir, you actually have to go outside and wait in line." And I'm like looking back on it with you know the maturity that comes with a little older, I'm like, I walked 15 steps into Parliament until a security guard, a single security guard said, he apologized to me and said, "Sorry, sir, it's outside," right? That's the Canada that I love. That's the Canada that I remember. Same. Not the Canada where the Prime Minister comes to London, Ontario, the Prime Minister of this country, and you love him or hate him, or you're, you know, doesn't matter where you're on the political spectrum. He had gravel and rocks thrown at him. Like, are you kidding me? And then you see what happened in Hamilton. Everybody has the right to protest, and they have the right to protest loud.
That wasn't
right?
The protest.
Yeah, that wasn't a protest. And the one point I'll end on that is, we're not just having this conversation about prime ministers. We're not just having this conversation about premiers. This is filtered down to municipal, like our mayors across the country, our school boards across the country, right? We've had, I can tell you, I can tell you stories, maybe some of them more off air, the detail, but we've had meetings at our school board, and I know it's been replicated over and over again, where we have protesters, violent protesters out there, right, trying to, and I don't even like to use the term protest, because again, to protest is one thing, but when
more of an intimidation thing.
When you're articulating through violence, through aggressive behavior, when you're doing all that stuff, you've crossed the line, and that's not the country that I love. That's not the country that I remember. And I don't know, to your point, whether we can put that genie back in the bottle, but it's frustrating. We got to do something about it, because we're only a matter of time, to Nathan's point, where we're all mourning collectively the loss of some leader because of this stuff. It's only a matter of time.
But that's the strange thing, is that this, like, the idea of sort of people being passionate or even angry en masse is nothing new. I can remember protests that were angry and passionate, but it's not, there's not an underpinning of violence as there is now. Like, it's almost as if they're violent and then they're kind of angry, and but it's just an angry, violent mob of people. And that's a new phenomenon. Again, I don't want people to think that, well, you don't mind people yelling. And of course, people, that's happened for centuries, and it should. But it, even no matter how passionate on whatever side people were on a decade ago, or certainly two decades ago, there wasn't, again, it wasn't underpinned by violence, and just it's very scary.
And even on social media now, and I think that's part of what the accelerant is here, I really do believe that, is social media. When accounts that I would say are political commentators or politicians from the conservative side of the spectrum tweeting out that video and saying, "Oh, this is excessive. We can't have this." Yeah. And then the response, you just see the replies are flooded with, "He deserves it, and he did this, and he did this." And like,
well, it's also every issue has become a life or death issue, at least in whether they mean it or not. But the way they present it, like, every issue is life or death.
You know, someone's like, "End the mandates." Like, what mandates? This is done.
I don't even know what they were, quote unquote, protesting there, because there are no mandates.
And if you want to be
the problem is, what is that you're constrained by common sense and logic and rational thought. And a lot of those people are not limited in the same sense, right? And so, listen, if you think it's okay to throw stuff at the Prime Minister, you're an idiot, straight up. Like, I can't sugarcoat it. You're a freaking idiot, right? And so in terms of the public discourse, I don't think you, not every opinion has the same degree of legitimacy. And if that's your opinion, then guess what? As far as I'm concerned, you've excluded yourself. You've disqualified yourself from actually having a conversation with, you know, quote unquote, the rest of society. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you agree or not, but that's how I feel. So
yeah, I just think that, and I've talked about this before, some of these people that want to yell at the prime minister about stuff that the prime minister has nothing to do with. And again, you don't have to like Justin Trudeau. I don't necessarily like Justin Trudeau, but I think there are some situations where people are just so far gone that they're not coming back.
Yeah.
You know, like this person is not coming back. Like an example, like, well, there's all sorts of examples, but just this person is so deep into the misinformation and, you know, outrage machine on social media rabbit hole that I just know you're not going to come back to being like a rational member of society. So we're going to have a lot of this problem over the next few years. And it's not going to go away.
And I keep thinking about this again, like becomes one, like another thing where people are going to think twice about putting their names on a ballot because it's now a security issue. It's a safety issue, not just for yourself, for your family, for your friends. We're discouraging people who are probably totally qualified to put their names on a ballot to represent at a municipal, provincial, or federal level, or at a school board level, whatever, to think twice about this. And I don't know.
Well, here's the thing: we don't have to look too far, and to democracies not unlike ours, in the not too distant past, Gabby Giffords, Joe Cox in the UK, like. People who are political representatives wind up getting seriously injured or worse based upon they are political representatives.
Yeah, and we used to take a measure of comfort. I'll speak for myself. I used to take a measure of comfort and a measure of solace in the fact that although, you know, we as Canadians, Canada isn't perfect, but we didn't have those same problems that the United States, their history with violence, their history with kind of violent political opposition. But I don't feel that way anymore. I feel like, yes, we're not the United States. To Nathan's point, that can't be the threshold that we measure ourselves against. But we've seen it seep into the Canadian political discourse. We've seen it seep into our general discourse. And I don't know what makes me think that we're different now in the sense that why do we think we're inoculated or insulated from the things that happen in the United States here? Sadly, and I hope, I pray that I'm wrong, but I don't think it's a question of if, but I think it's when we find ourselves in a situation where we're mourning the loss of one of our political leaders. And I don't care if you're conservative, liberal, NDP, green, whatever, whatever, right? There's going to come a day where this vitriol and this hate and this rhetoric manifests itself in a violent act being perpetrated towards one of our leaders. And at that point, we'll look back and say, could we have done something? Should we have done something? Well, we're living that reality right now. And what are we going to do? That's the question.
And here's maybe the sad answer to that. Maybe there was nothing we could have done. Maybe this and perhaps, you know, have government work a little bit better for more people. And I think part of the rise of some of this stuff is government has failed a lot of people and that could have been better. But just with the rise of the outrage machine, maybe there was nothing we could do about that. Maybe there are just people who stand to make money off of getting people angry and that's something we want to do. I don't know if that's the case, but I've wondered, was there sort of a fork in the road here that we missed? Or was this just sort of the way that this was going to go no matter what we did? I don't know the answer to that, but I have wondered about it. I don't know. Let's wrap up the conversation here just because we're pressed for time. So thank you so much to Shobhita and to Ali and to Nathan for coming in and having a conversation with us on the Friday Roundtable today. Please continue to download, listen to, subscribe to, and review the Craig Needles podcast, which of course you can find at londonnewstoday.ca, classicrock981.com, and on your very favorite podcast apps.
The Craig Needles podcast is a presentation of the Blackburn Media Podcast Network.